The book, surprisingly, is 50 years old. It definitely belongs to a bygone era, but it still has a little bit of residual power to it. It's a lightning rod for opinions. I study 20th century China. I'm interested in Mao and Maoism. I became interested in learning more about the Little Red Book, and I started digging, and I realized there really wasn't that much that people had said about it. The really interesting thing about this project, it's called Mao's Little Red Book, A Global History, and the subtitle is really important because this book really was a global book. As I began to imagine how I could write about it, I came to realize there was no way that I could do that myself. This is a book that gets translated into about 36 languages officially, unofficially, more like 50 languages. It's a book that takes on a life of its own and the history of all of these different nations around the world, and it's used in different ways. So it was actually a really exciting opportunity to get in touch with scholars who are working in all these different places around the world. In the book, we have people doing research in at least 12 languages. It was a really exciting opportunity for me to kind of step out of my confines as a historian of China and get plugged into a network of people who weren't already connected to each other.
Presumably, at the time, Mao was a little bit busy. He was trying to gather his forces, consolidate power, hold off the nationalists, deal with the Russians, and he comes out with this book. How did he accomplish that?
Mao himself had very little to do with the actual creation of the book. It emerges in the early 1960s in China. It emerges from the military. The idea from it came from journalists inside the army. The editors and publishers of military newspapers kind of got into the habit of printing Mao quotations in the masthead of their newspapers. Then they started thinking, well, the quotation should fit whatever the lead news story is. So they needed kind of a topical index of quotations relating to all different kinds of situations and stories that might appear in the paper. And then from there, they created this kind of card catalog, and they got the idea to compile it together into a kind of a field manual for the soldiers. It's the field manual origins of the book that actually explain its peculiar little size. It has to fit into the breast pocket of an army uniform, and the famous red vinyl cover, which makes it waterproof. So it's really just designed to be convenient for a soldier to carry around, a little quick reference guide if you want to find an inspirational quotation on a particular topic. You pull it out of your pocket, open it up to the appropriate chapter, and 10 seconds later, you've got a Mao quote.
It is the internet or the text message of the day.
It really is. One of our contributors, Andrew Jones, who's also a professor at UC Berkeley, has a really interesting chapter on comparing the quotation to the sort of 60s phenomenon pop song, musical hook. The book is portable, but the quotations in a way are kind of portable. They're kind of memorable. A lot of them would fit into a Twitter. They're just like little snippets that are easily movable and easily transmittable about. In Marxism, there's a longstanding criticism of capitalism and of commodity culture. This is kind of an instance where a really radical form of Marxism intersects with commodity culture.
And very iconic even to this day, as tourists can go around Beijing and other areas and see the Little Red Book being sold in stalls.
Oh, very much so. I mean, you can buy the Little Red Book today in China. It's a very popular tourist item. I think Chinese people feel a little bit more conflicted about it, in a way. It's ubiquitous, but it's the kind of thing people keep in the bottom of a drawer, you know, maybe tied up with a lot of ambivalent kind of memories and nostalgia. The thing you don't really want to look at, but you can't quite throw away, it still has that kind of a power in China today. But the meaning of the book is really, I think, has changed over time. There's always kind of been this tension between the Little Red Book as something dangerous, subversive, but also kind of a comical pop culture light feeling about it.
Your research gets into different aspects of the Little Red Book that we really haven't looked at over the past 50 years. Explain a little bit about what you were looking at.
There are a few things that we wanted to bring out in the project, things that hadn't really been said about the Little Red Book. The first is this idea that the Little Red Book is not just a text, it's an object that moves around and has a life of its own. Often, people aren't even really reading it, right? Often, reading the thing is not the important. Often it's waving it at somebody or having it in your pocket, the symbolism of the thing that allows it to be used in many different ways. By taking a global perspective, were able to step outside of China. So there are several chapters about China itself, which I think are really interesting. But we also have the opportunity to show what happens when this thing moves around. It travels and takes on a life of its own. What do people do with the Little Red Book in France, in Italy, in Yugoslavia, Tanzania, India, all of these places that we talk about? People put the book to their own uses, a tool and a device that they can use to pursue their own ends. I don't know what it is about the text, if it's the little size or the red color or the words that are inside it, but the text seems to have had a sort of talismanic property such that someone who's holding the text feels empowered to violence.
Were there any veins of a positive, nonviolent action coming out of the book that you were able to discern in your research?
Yeah, I think one thread that does come through is because it's an authoritative text, in some ways we describe it almost like a religious text. Even in its circulation, I mean, the only books that are comparable to it are things like the Bible and the Quran. As a religious text, you can imagine that maybe it holds a kind of power over the believers. But on the other hand, you can see in places where the book is adopted, including in China, there's almost a religious reformation. It's almost like an education in the liberal arts, an education in rhetoric. And because the text can be used to argue for so many things, in a way it breaks down that kind of authority and allows people to begin to articulate their own desires, their own beliefs, in a way to begin to speak freely. So there's, ironically, you know, we can view the text as a tool, a totalitarian dictatorship, but it has this ironic quality of kind of emancipating people's minds and teaching them how to think and speak freely.